I do appreciate the big blackboard, though, anyway.
There isn't any way of lowering it, though, is it?
No.
I'll try.
Anyway, what we tried to do last evening was to discuss this basic problem of religion as communication. How, in fact, men in all religions communicate to personal supernatural powers and to impersonal powers, and also to those particular areas of life that are subhuman. Now, what we described the other day, yes, it was really this communication on the lower story. We didn't try to distinguish between religions, and of course there are simply hundreds of different religions in the world. If you consider all of the so-called primitive peoples, 1,000 groups or more, with varying religious beliefs and varying practices, but fundamentally and basically, all of them engage in communication. And all of them establish a relationship to the personal powers, the impersonal powers, and they have also a relationship to that subhuman level, though expressed in many different ways. Though in one particular society there may be no sacrifice at all, as for example among the Hopis. In another area, as in West Africa, sacrifice may be at the very heart of the religious system of propitiation. All religions differ, but all religions have these basic characteristics. Now, rather than dealing with this total gamut of religions, let's look at the matter of religion in terms of the so-called world religions and compare them. For here I think that we may be able to see more clearly than we may have seen before the difference between these world religions and Christianity. Also remember, even here, we are not dealing with the theoretical forms of these religions. We're dealing with the form that people actually practice. Not the ideal structures, but the real structures. Not where the theologians live, but where the masses of the people actually are involved. Well, let's look first at Hinduism. In Hinduism, we have the same kind of communication. You have, for example, the gods above, and there are all kinds of gods and demons and devils. In fact, there's simply a panoply of hundreds of thousands of gods, because when Hinduism, in its Aryan leadership, moved into India, it took in all of these minor religious groups and tribes, and it simply amalgamated the whole thing into one colossal system. And the Hindus themselves never tried to work out the scheme, actually. It was only when Westerners went to India that they began to work out a so-called theology of it all. So there were gods at the top and all the way down, of course, to the ghosts. And of every variety in between, of tier upon tier, and all kinds of competing gods and supplementary gods and all that went with it. And, of course, on the other side, there was also a great belief in the cosmos, and also in household magic, if you like. And below this was man. And man, interestingly enough, was structured in a pyramid structure, but he was also carefully organized into four basic castes. The caste of the head, the intellectual. The caste of the arms of the worker. The caste of the belly. The caste of the feet. The servant caste. And of course there were those people who had violated certain kinds of caste restrictions, and so they became the outcasts, really another caste of their own. Another kind of servant caste. Now below this particular structuring of man, there was also, of course, the animals and the plants and objects. Now this particular caste system, of course, worked with the priestly caste at the top. These are the Brahmins. the priestly caste that headed everything up. And then underneath this, of course, was the warrior class and the merchant class, the agricultural class and the servant class. Now, this particular structure was interestingly designed to accomplish a particular purpose, to stratify society and to keep it that way. For it was a technique by which the Brahmins controlled society. But there was also something else. For all of this structure of life was, as it were, enclosed, because outside of this was something else, namely Brahman. For Brahman, not Brahmin, but Brahman, which exists all the way around this, is actually reality. For according to the Hindu view of the world, reality is spiritual, not material. And so all of this that is, including the gods themselves, are really not real. They're simply phenomenal. And the thing that is really real is spirit. And this spirit stuff is Brahman. And man naturally wishes to escape from this that is unreal. And to do so, he's dependent upon two factors. First of all, he must perform ritual observance. For only in that way can he eventually escape from this unreality of things, of phenomena, over into the realness of spirit world. Now, if say he is born in this particular caste, he cannot move up to another caste during his lifetime. But he has to perform all kinds of ritual observance to keep himself absolutely clean from any kind of contamination, to never violate caste, to never violate all of these ritual rules. And if he does, and he is dependent upon this Brahman, for only the priestly caste can make possible the proper performance of these ritual observances. And if he does everything the best he can, he may be reborn a higher caste. When he dies, if he again has been almost perfect in what he has done, he may be reborn a higher caste. And finally, after hundreds and hundreds of reincarnations, he may be born a Brahmin. And as a Brahmin, he has the possibility then of entering into a state of sort of semi or demigod, and eventually to escape into the great world soul. Now, of course, if he's not a good man, he may be reborn an outcast, or born an animal. And this is why you do not kill snakes or any kind of animal, because this might be grandfather. At least it is some soul. It is some spirit being. And you do not kill. Now, in a sense, some of these animals are placed up here because a Brahmin may pray, for example, to be reborn a sacred cow. For the sacred cow may be one of the stages by which the Brahmin himself escapes into Brahman. But if he is even a poor animal, he can be reborn a plant or even an inanimate object. And he goes up again, and he may fall back again, and up again and fall back. In fact, it may take him simply thousands of reincarnations before he is reabsorbed into this great world soul of Brahman. Now, two things are fundamental. First of all, he must perform ritual observance. And the ritual observance depends upon the Brahmin class. Now, it is also interesting, of course, that in Hinduism you have this almost incredible multiplicity of gods and spirits.
And therefore, Hinduism doesn't find any particular difficulty of taking Jesus Christ in and adding him to the panoply as a demigod or a god, if you like. They don't particularly object. In fact, the Hindu can say all religions are essentially the same. For ultimately, reality is spirit. And we simply go by different ways. We have chosen this way of ritual observance in the Brahmin class, but eventually we all are reabsorbed into the great world soul. So Hinduism can without doubt be the most inclusive religion that the world has ever known. Now let's look at Buddhism. For remember I said last night that Buddhism was really a reaction against Hinduism. For Buddha saw all of this fantastic amount of idolatry, and he said the real problem was, of course, ignorance and desire. So ignorance would be overcome by enlightenment, which Buddha means enlightenment, and of course, desire would be overcome by self-discipline. This was an anti-idolatrous movement. The only tragedy was within 100 years there were simply thousands of idols in the form of Buddha. A tooth in one and a hair in another and a piece of a bone in another, until there are enough relics of Buddha to make simply hundreds of Buddhas. And all of these statues with their individual power. In fact, if you go to Chiang Mai in the northern part of Thailand, you climb up a hill and then you go up 100 or 200 steps. It's supposed to be good if you have malaria, and if you have it very bad, you'll never get to the top. But when you do get up there, carrying your, first of all, some little gold leaf that you put on the statue, or some water that you pour over the head of this Buddha, and it flows down over the genitals and into the hair of a woman and then on down onto a Taoist lion. And all of this has now just become idolatrous. That's all. But what is the basic system of it? In Buddhism, you have, of course, also, interestingly enough, the gods. For there are lots of gods in Buddhism, in the popular form of Buddhism. And there are various Buddhas, good for this or that or the other thing. And there are plenty of demons and all kinds of spirits. Why, in Thailand, there are always these gnats, not G-N-A-T-S, just N-A-T-S. These spirits that are always inhabiting the place. And people have their little god house with their elephants outside in order to protect themselves. It wasn't more than about 10 years ago when in this great city of Chiang Mai, I suppose it's the second or third largest city of Thailand, when they had an epidemic broke out. The Buddhist priest took a silver thread and made the thread go all the way around the city in order to protect it from disease. People still take Buddhism very seriously. And all of these demonic influences. So you have the gods at the top, and you've got plenty of ghosts and spirits and the gnats, or whatever they happen to be in the various areas. And in Buddhism, you also have lots of magic and belief in the cosmos. And from the cosmos down to plenty of individual magic within the home. The little spirit elephants and the rest that you'll find. And then, of course, within this structure, you have man. And man is pictured more or less in the same kind of pyramidal structure. But there are no castes in Buddhism. This is the important factor. Now, there is, of course, a belief in Buddhism that you have animals below man, and then you have plants, and you've got objects, and man, by reincarnation, may move up in society, in structure, or he may move on down and have to be reincarnated again. This belief in reincarnation is a very important one. A missionary friend of mine gave a New Testament to a Buddhist friend of his. And he saw him some time later and said, "Well, how did you like it?" "Oh," he said, "absolutely magnificent. I've never read a story like it. Why, this man Jesus, he was born and he died, he born and died, born and died, born and died. In 4 reincarnations he made it." He thought the 4 Gospels were 4 different lives of Jesus.
Why wouldn't he think so? Four reincarnations and he made it into nirvana. Why, even Buddha himself, you see,
took, according to popular legend, about 1,000.
Well, this is all very interesting.
For outside of this type of thing in Buddhism, there is likewise nirvana. Now, nirvana is much like Brahman, but it is not the same. For nirvana is nothingness. Now, this something we mentioned earlier this afternoon when we were discussing this problem of mathematics. Nirvana is not nothing. Nirvana is zero. And zero is not nothing. Zero is the significant absence of something. Now, this is a very important distinction. You know, even in mathematics, this is not nothing. This is a significant absence of 1 to 9, isn't it? Of course, the Spanish have a wonderful little proverb. He's a zero on the left-hand side. You don't amount to anything. That's nothing. But a zero on the right-hand side is something. Significant absence of something. Now, in Buddhism, all of this is unreality. This is what is, but this isn't real. What is real is what isn't. So in order to escape from what is, which is only appearance, you want to escape into what isn't. But what isn't really is, and what is just doesn't amount to anything. Now, this may sound a little strange to you, but there's a lot of logic behind it. For if you believe that these phenomenal things are transitory and not eternal, then the thing that is eternal is the opposite of what is, namely the negation of what we now have. And the negation of what we have is absolutely the opposite of what we have, and therefore, in terms of what we have, it is nothingness, zero, the significant absence of what we have. Therefore, there is no continuation of individual personality, for that would be dividing up, and that would be phenomenal, not spiritual. So you see, Buddhism goes the logical step beyond Hinduism in its structures. Now, for Buddhism, there is a very important factor. You do not need to go on up to the top class before you can escape into nirvana. In fact, enlightenment can come to any man at any level if he will simply accept enlightenment and engage in self-discipline. Also, in Buddhism, you have saviors, which you do not have in Hinduism. For in Buddhism, there are certain great personalities who claim that they would not enter into nirvana. They would stay on the edge, as it were, of nirvana until they could take all of their disciples with them. So they are refusing to go on into nirvana, and they make a way for their disciples. This, for example, is supposedly true of Nichiren, the great Japanese Buddhist saint, whose adherents have now developed a form of Buddhism which is the complete antithesis of the Buddhism of Gautama. Well, there are some people who claim to be Christians who certainly have the antithesis of what Christ was talking about. Now, escape now is possible for any man who will receive enlightenment and engage in self-discipline, and, in special circumstances, who is willing to believe in a savior who stands at the edge of nirvana, ready to let his followers through. Now, there's no doubt about the fact that in the world as a whole, the greatest competitor of Christianity is Buddhism. For Buddhism has developed what at least seems to many people a very rational view of life. After all, enlightenment and self-discipline are meaningful. And Buddhism does not encourage, at least ostensibly, conflict and fighting and war. And Buddhism has also developed some of the most significant artistic forms that any religion has ever developed. You see, the essence of Buddhism is this complete
indifference to the world in which we live. In fact, you see, Buddhism doesn't even believe this world is worth redeeming. For the view of the Orient is a cyclical view of history. There is morning and noon and afternoon and night. There is young manhood, or birth and young manhood, adulthood, old age and death. There is spring and summer, fall and winter. Life just keeps going round and round. Oh, it may be changing at the time, but it will eventually revert. So therefore, life is not worth redeeming. The important thing is that you escape from it.
Of course, this makes a great deal of difference too, doesn't it, in motivation for missionary work.
Most Buddhists cannot understand why a missionary would be motivated to do missionary work other than he's gaining merit. And therefore, if you do anything for a Buddhist, the Buddhist is likely not to say thank you, for he's given you an opportunity to gain merit. He's done you a favor. You haven't done him a favor. And this is one of the most difficult things to do, get along with in Buddhist life, because it seems so utterly thankless, and yet the Buddhist has been giving the Christian the chance to gain merit
and therefore go on into nirvana.
But Buddhism, you see, with its artistic form, has gained a great many converts. As you probably know, Buddhists are now sending missionaries to the United States and to Europe. And they're gaining many, many adherents. And probably the softening up process of Buddhism has been through its art. For no other religious group has so concentrated upon its art. Notice those beautiful Buddhist paintings. The mountains never quite touch the ground, do they? You look upon a scene never from the hard ground and looking up, but you're always up there someplace in the sky, looking down upon it. But the world is not quite real. Why? Because reality is not the world, but nirvana. And the Buddhists, both consciously and unconsciously, have expressed their art and religion in highly significant ways.
Unfortunately, for so much modern Christian art,
we only have drawing book cartoon kinds of illustrations. But there are some very significant developments in Christian art.
By the way, on the side, perhaps what is now being done in Germany is the most significant development in Christian art that we've had for a long, long time. For in some of these large cathedrals, some of the statuary, some of the paintings, you simply cannot see it without being deeply moved.
Tremendously important. However, let's go on now to Islam. For in Islam, we have a different picture. In Islam, we have at the top Allah and the Quran and faith. And popular Islam has never decided which is on top. In fact, neither are the theologians. For it is now heresy to say that Muhammad wrote the Quran. In fact, one man said that in Egypt. He was a leading politician, and he was simply out of office. It is heresy to say that Muhammad wrote the Quran. The Quran, which now exists, is supposed to be a literal consonant for consonant. The vowels were never written. Consonant for consonant duplication of the Quran which exists in heaven, which Allah himself must consult. And the Quran has been called the eternal Quran. The Quran has been exalted above God. And there are some of our Christian brethren who've exalted the Bible above God, just by the way. Now, there has never been a decision on this matter of fate, because the will of Allah is never the merciful will of Allah. It is this inexorable will of Allah. So that actually the will of Allah becomes this kind of impersonal power in this universe. And you have, of course, Allah, and you've got the devil and angels
and plenty of jinns, these genii that we read about when we were kids. The jinns who are populating the whole universe of Islam. And many people are far more concerned about placating the jinns than they are praying to Allah. For why not be concerned by some spirit that's going to do you positive damage than to pray to Allah who might do you good? In fact, people are usually more concerned, as we suggested, about the evil that is closer to them than Allah, who is a long ways away. Well, now, within Islam, we also have the pyramiding of structures, but it is, as it were, an interesting division right here. Males are here, females are here. For females just don't rate too much in Islam. For example, in Islam, you're supposed to tell the truth, except to an infidel, in the case of life and death, in order to propagate Islam, and to women. Now, that includes about 50% of the conversations. Women only exist primarily for the pleasure of men. Now, of course, there are differences of Islam, the Shiites, the Sunnites, and the other groups, and there are certain differences there, but by and large, in popular Islam, women get into heaven simply to be pleasure objects for men. But where is salvation? Men, this society also is concerned about animals and plants and objects, but not in terms of worship, although some of them may be amulets. Some may be good luck charms. Really, these are all for exploitation. And Islam exploits this kind of life. In fact, I suppose no place in the world where animals suffer so much from abuse as in Islam. However, salvation exists in Islam. But interestingly enough, this salvation comes by submission. This is what Muslim means. Muslim literally means one who has submitted. Islam means submission. For the Muslims jeered at the Christians in the 8th century, calling them people of the book. Because you see, the Christians had become so interested in the book, the Bible, that they weren't practicing it. And the Muslims said, we don't just have a book, we submit to the will of God. We are Muslims. It's also true that many communities, even Christian communities, welcomed the Muslims in because they had suffered so much from Christian lords in Damascus and Byzantium and other places. For these Christian rulers had become anything but Christian in their dealing with people. Little did the folks know the kind of price they were going to pay for welcoming in the Muslim overlords. But it is true that for a time at least, the Muslims were more righteous than some of these Christian overlords. It is also very interesting that in the Crusades, we have a very perverted picture. For the Muslims, by and large, were more tolerant than the Christians. When Saracens took over Jerusalem finally from the Crusaders, they offered the church authorities the privilege of redeeming from slavery every one of the soldiers at about half price. And the church authorities put all of the gold and the jewels from the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and other places and loaded them into their carts and went off to the shore and sailed away with the permission of the Saracens, and they didn't redeem one soldier from slavery. Interesting little tidbits of stories, aren't they? Well, it's a fascinating way in which we retell history. Now, I'm not trying to say that the Muslims were all correct, but certainly the Christians violated Christianity in the Crusades in a form which is almost incredible. For remember, in Islam, that doesn't stand for the cross. That stands for the hilt of a sword. Well, also salvation occurs to Islam, not merely by submission to God, but by the solidarity of the community of the faith which enforces the will of Allah. Therefore, you can have a holy war. And we have had holy wars. What were the Crusades if they weren't holy wars? This is part of the history, you see. And this is why it is so difficult to reach Islam. Remember, even today, the Muslims can see that series of castles going all the way from Turkey right down through Asia Minor, clear on down to Egypt. One castle after another, close enough and on top of hills so that they could signal to one another by fire to call for help. These castles simply remembrance of those times in which the Crusaders drank and gambled and lived rather unchristian lives. For even today, around those Crusaders' castles, in the immediate vicinities, there is an amazing percentage of blonde children. For there was so much miscegenation at that time. And of course, in the Middle East, people don't move away from their hometown so much. Well, part of this is the story of Christianity. Well, and part of the difficulty. Now, in salvation, of course, here, for a female, comes primarily because of the male in the family. And salvation comes because of communication. And of course, there is faith, and there's also a lot of magic, as I was mentioning, all these jujus that West African Muslims have. And their salvation, by the will of Allah, through obedience to the Quran, submission to God's will, and the solidarity of the community. And this is the reason why the Muslim community is so absolutely solid. Any individual who becomes a Christian is immediately buried ceremonially. And all members of the family are under obligation to see that this man is killed. So that the number of Muslims are very few, and those who do exist are often in other countries. I have a very good friend who is a Iraqi. He became a Christian when he was in Switzerland. He returned to his family one time and had to escape for his life. His family actually followed him to Switzerland and tried to poison him to death in Switzerland. He's now working in Africa. The intensity of this cohesion of the community is almost incredible. I was told I should wipe this off with a wet cloth because I've now got to change some of these and put on Christianity. Now, do I have to wait a while before I can mark? I'll see. Now, let's look at Christianity in comparison. For Christianity has some interesting forms. At the top, normally, we put God. And then for the average Christian, I'm talking about the average Christian, not you folks. The next is Jesus Christ. And if people believe in him at all, the Holy Spirit. But sort of off to the side. Because he's just a little bit over on the magic side. Sort of impersonal. Right? To most Christians. Now, over here, there's a problem with Mary. For you see, for some, Mary is above Jesus Christ. For some, she's actually above God. For you see, Mary is the mother of God. For being the mother of Jesus Christ, and Jesus Christ is God, therefore she becomes the mother of God. And of course, in Islam especially, this is simply unthinkable. In fact, even the first verse of Mark, speaking about the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Well, this is incredible to a Muslim. For a Muslim thinks, Son of God, who is God's wife? Sexual intercourse. Oh, this is unthinkable. This is a horrible kind of thing. You don't talk about God that way. When you talk about Mary, the mother of God,
You have something which is just emotionally repulsive. It is very interesting, you know, that the Athanasians were the ones who were so anxious to press the idea of the Trinity, Jesus Christ being God. And it was the Arians who were worried about this, because you see, they were more missionary than the Athanasians. And when they got over into Mesopotamia, and they began to talk about Jesus Christ as God and Mary as the mother of God, then all immediately you had all of this concept of the earth mother that started the fertility cult practices of the Middle East. And of course, this actually got so far into Christianity that the Mass in the Roman Church is primarily a fertility cult thing, not a covenant meal. For every time the God is slain and people drink of his blood, and this is only a carryover of fertility cult practices, which were so widespread in the Middle East. However, we also have a little problem as to where to put the devil. Because the devil and the angels, are the angels stronger than the devil, or the devil stronger than the angels? And then we've got some spirits, especially the evil spirits, and a few ghosts and gremlins and other things. And this is terribly important to Christians. Just Christians in general. People who call themselves Christians. All right? Maybe you wouldn't think they weren't, but let's admit that they might be, at least call themselves that. Now, there's an interesting thing in popular Christianity that this line doesn't go right up here. It sort of shoves off to the side. And there's a little place at least for the cosmos. For reading horoscopes, for finding out what your future is going to be. It's simply amazing how people don't want to really know just their weight. They also want to know their good luck. Fantastic, isn't it? What's the relationship between weight and good luck anyway? And these almost incredible little cards. I don't see how anybody can write so many different ones and have them all so delightfully ambiguous. And then, of course, we also have black cats. Of course, in Egypt, black cats are good luck, but in America, they aren't good luck. And we have all this type of thing. We do believe in some kind of magic. This problem of the Holy Spirit and the rest, of course, we are lined up in the typical triangle, and then we also believe in the exploitation of that which is subhuman. Now, I can't take time to describe some of these problems. But I do think it is very important for us to realize that psychologically, we as Christians put many humans down in the subhuman level. Very important analysis was made by a Czech anthropologist visiting in an Oregon community. And she said there were three kinds of people. Americans, who were people, whites. Mexicans, who were psychologically equivalent to machinery. You kept your machinery well oiled, you kept it in good condition, you also provided well for these Mexicans, you kept them well fed so that they could work well. Psychologically, Mexicans were in the same class as machinery. What about the Indians? They were in the class of scenery, animals. You went out to the reservation to see the Indians, like you went out to see the deer and the elk and other interesting things. You never thought of having an Indian in your home. And you certainly would never have a Mexican in for a meal. They're machinery and animals. There are an awful lot of people, you know, who really don't think that Negroes are quite people. Sometimes people wish they weren't. They could be dealt with more easily, with an easier conscience. Remember, over 2,000 Negroes have been lynched since the Civil War. And largely by people who call themselves Christians. Okay. Now, what's happened in our situation? Well, amazingly, something very significant. For so many Christians, so-called,
this doesn't really have much reality up here. This is really too relevant. Let me tell you what happened on an
airplane trip I was making. I think it was from Taiwan to Japan. And I sat down beside a very interesting fellow. He was working with a firm of consultants, economists, for the U.S. government. They had just conducted several months' analysis of the economy of Taiwan. This man is he's an official in one of the important churches, Protestant churches, in the West Coast. And, of course, I asked him all about his work and one thing and another. We had a very nice conversation. And finally, he asked me what my work was. So we got on to religion. And after a little while, he said, "Oh, by the way, this business of the Holy Spirit, do you regard him as sort of personal or more an influencer?" I said, "Well, frankly, I regard him as a person." "Oh," I said, I hold to the position of the Trinity, generally." So he sort of, excused the situation. We went on talking about other things, religion, one thing another. And then he came out, "Oh, by the way, I wanted to ask you this, we speak of Jesus Christ as the Son of God. Now, do you feel that he is the Son of God in sort of a special sense, different than other people? Or you don't really hold that position, do you, in your place?" And he was sort of flattering me, about my education, all that kind of baloney. And so I said, well, really, I feel that Jesus Christ is the Son of God in a very unique sense, different than other people. And they said, "Very interesting, very interesting." So we went out talking about something else. And then finally he said, I do want to ask you this business of God, I can't help but feel," he said, "that God isn't just, this person that we talk about in our churches, but more this power of the universe, this dynamic thing which has done so much in the world. This is the type of direction in your thinking, isn't it?" I had to say, "Well, no," and I tried to explain. And we went ahead chatting with things, and we talked about things at county. I always find, though, that in witnessing to a man like this, that I always go just as far as he wants to talk. But once he puts up a barrier, I don't argue with him. Because if I do, I'm only driving him further into his position. But anyway, later on in the conversation, he said, a funny thing happened to us. See, we bought a new house out in San Francisco area. And a lovely home. Lady had just passed away recently, and we got it very, very good price and all. And he said, "The funny thing happened. Why, the first night we locked up all the doors, and the next morning, all the doors were open." So we were rather concerned. And he said, "We closed up everything the next night, and the next morning we got up, all the doors were open." He said, "The third night this thing happened." He said, "I was really concerned." So he said, the next night I heard some noise down in the out in the living room. He said, "I went out there and I, knowing that this woman had died just recently, I sort of addressed her by name and said to her, 'Now, Mrs. So-and-so, we love your home very much. We know you loved it. We'll take very good care of it. Please don't be concerned about this.'" And he said, "From then on, we never had any of our doors open." It's interesting, isn't it? This man cannot believe in the traditional God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, but he does believe in ghosts. This line simply swings over this way. Just as it swings over this way and leaves place for magic, so it swings back this way and leaves place for ghosts and spirits and all kinds of other phenomena that people love to believe in. What has taken this place? It is scientism. Scientism is science made absolute. Scientists don't do it, but other people do. And remember, at the present time, people are actually reading more science fiction than they're reading science. For science is, through its science fiction, developing its own mythology. It's developing its own form of religion. For people want to believe. Now, we've looked at Christianity and its so-called
dramatic form of what is happening.
I want to suggest something about the history of Christianity because it fits in to this swinging arc. If we analyze religion in the time of the Middle Ages, we will say that on top is God. For the Middle Ages, by and large, took God seriously. So you see, all peoples have to construct a raison d'être, a reason for existence, a basis for life, don't they? And in the Middle Ages, this basis for life, which was essentially Christian in its general orientation, said that God was on top. And that God mediated his truth through his church. And that this church had the right of appointing kings and rulers. And through the kings and the nobles, the great masses of the people were controlled. And the sanctions for life, for the structuring of life, came from God through the church, through the kings and the noblemen, down to the masses of the people. Now, this was a very, very nice structure. And below this, of course, was the subhuman element. Animals and the rest, but this was always for man's control. Now, this worked beautifully for a while. And then along came the Renaissance and the Reformation. For the Renaissance was a kind of reform in learning, and the Reformation was a complete change in religion. And what the Reformation did really was to X out the church as a power. Of course, the church stayed on. We even had the Inquisition. But an Inquisition is always a sign that the enemy is losing out. For you never become absolutely totalitarian in thought control until you're very much worried about your position. So witch hunts are a sign of failure, not of success. But you see, an interesting thing happened. For once the church was X'd out, the next doctrine that came in was not that the Pope was the vicar of Jesus Christ on earth, the one who mediated the will of God, but there came a doctrine called the divine right of kings. For once, the church wasn't the mediator of this divine power. The king had to be the mediator of this divine power. And then you see, about 300 years later, we had another movement, the Age of Revolution, the end of the 18th century. And at that particular time, the kings and the noblemen got X'd out as a real power. And then a divinely sanctioned humanism, as it were, arose. For Jefferson and others said that all men have certain inalienable rights received from God. And on the basis of these inalienable rights possessed by the people are able to organize themselves into governments. And they neither need the church nor the kings and the noblemen. And we had the doctrine, the humanistic doctrine of inalienable rights. Divinely sanctioned rights. And then came the age of science. And for all practical purposes, God got X'd out. In the thinking of people. Let's face it. Of course, in any poll of people in the United States, 98% say they believe in God. But they're not more than 20% of them ever behave as though they really believed in God. We are idealistically theists. We are practically atheists. Certainly the majority. People don't regulate their lives on the basis that they really believe in God. They certainly don't believe in the final judgment. If that has anything to do with God. They certainly don't believe in the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Or the God revealed in scriptures. Of course, they do have a projection of a Santa Claus, as we said. But that's just about how deep it goes. Now, Nietzsche was right. For the intellectual of Europe, for the intellectual of the Western world, because of scientism, God is dead. Oh, God, of course, is always addressed politely in political assemblies. He's always
put on coins or one thing or another if it's necessary to make people feel there's a little bit of divine sanction here. But people aren't really awfully worried about what he's going to do, because they really don't reckon their lives on the basis of him. And therefore, practical purposes, he's dead. Now, what did this mean? It meant that people no longer had any supernatural sanctions for the organization of society. And you can't live like that. People couldn't live like that. And people had to find some other sanction for life. And instead of going to the supernatural, they went to the subhuman to find a sanction for life. And they found it in evolution, didn't they? For people said, God doesn't exist. How do you know about this? The sanction for life is going to exist in this subhuman values. And humanism could not maintain itself. For real humanism can only exist where there is a God-given inalienable rights. And humanism degenerated into naturalism. For man is now not just himself, man comes from something else. For man is never content just to be himself. He's got to have some other validation. He's got to have sanctions which are either supernatural or natural. And he found them in this natural area. Evolution with its concept of the survival of the fittest. Now remember, that wasn't Darwin's expression, that was Herbert Spencer's expression. For he applied this to social evolution in terms of individuals. And this concept of evolution took two political forms. One form was fascism. Fascism took biological evolution seriously. For fascism always talked about the superman and the super race, right? Or did you grow up on Nazi propaganda? Well, they believed it. And it was based on biological evolution. Now, the thing collapsed. First of all, because it's biologically wrong. There isn't any such super race. And the next thing is, they couldn't demonstrate their superiority. They made a lot of stupid mistakes. But in passing, just let me sound a note here. You see, Nazism swept in as a rightist movement, and it appealed tremendously to the evangelicals in Germany. It was the Lutherans that opposed Hitler, not the conservatives. And the conservatives have had a long, hard struggle ever since their tragic mistake of swallowing rightist propaganda, hook, line, and sinker. It's interesting that rightists in the present day in the United States are doing the same thing. For there's propaganda abroad in the United States that simply makes me shudder. I was keenly interested in Hitler propaganda during college days, and I read a lot of it and listened to him over the radio. And the echoes of it at the present time are almost shuddering, terrifying. Anyway, there's another form of this naturalism based on subhuman sanctions, and that is communism, far more subtle than fascism. For you see, this is exactly why communism opposes the cult of personality. For it does not believe in the superman and the super race. It is international in scope, and it looks not to biological evolution, but to dialectical materialism. For it is concerned with historical evolution. And the problem we face today is not the problem of science and the Bible, the problem of history and the Bible. For here is the point of conflict with communism. Of course, in communism you have this very neat, beautiful Hegelian system of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, where you know in the ancient world the nomads and the farmers were in conflict, and you had ancient civilization. You had the slaves and the masters and classic civilization. You had the serfs and the lords, and you had the industrial revolution. And you have labor, the proletariat and capital, and you have the communist revolution. And every one of these thesis, antithesis, and synthesis on a higher level is a beautiful system. The trouble is, Hegel was just dead wrong. But it doesn't mean that people don't believe it. For remember, there's no fool a big enough fool that he can't get other fools to follow him. Now, Marx was no fool. He had a tremendous amount of data. Now, of course, he's having to be revised, and even the Russians are revising Marx and Lenin. In fact, you cannot buy an unexpurgated copy of Das Kapital in Russia, for there's just too much that doesn't square up with the revolution. However, this is historically incorrect. This model is overly simplified. New advances are not made out of conflict, but are made by that creative minority that Toynbee and other people have talked about, who are changing society. Nevertheless, and it is certainly true, that communism has passed its, shall we call it, intellectual zenith, but that doesn't mean that it's passed its power zenith. For all great movements pass their intellectual zenith before they pass their power zenith. And communism is still, of course, on the way up. Now, as a system, it's not too efficient. It's top-heavy and filled with suspicion. And communism is not able to predict where that creative minority will come from. And therefore, it is terribly inefficient. Nevertheless, it is certainly a problem to be reckoned with in the present world. What else? Interestingly enough, in our own day, we are now faced with something else. You see, fascism and communism, this particular structure of the world, has now largely been debunked by the intellectual. Fascism and communism have had a great appeal. But it's interesting that one group of philosophers who are having the greatest appeal to our modern world at the present time have a great deal to teach us. The existentialists. I don't go home saying I'm an existentialist. I'm not. But nevertheless, here is something that you and I ought to know about. For it is the dominant philosophy in Europe, and it is certainly increasingly so in the United States. Now, there are two forms of existentialism. There is the God-oriented type of Kierkegaard and others, where the whole idea is to cut away everything between God and man and put God and man in a new relationship, one to another, without all of the ecclesiastical claptrap. And this is one way of dealing with the thing. But the far more extensive existentialism is the man-oriented existentialism. And this man-oriented existentialism, Jean-Paul Sartre, Heidegger, and a number of others, Karl Jaspers, have simply said, as far as the supernatural is concerned, we can't know anything about it anyway. And what we do know about it is simply absurd. It doesn't make any sense. It's not rational. There's no meaning to it. And one of the key words in existentialism, as you know, is this word absurd, especially in the French connotations of this word. But existentialists have gone further. And it's not enough for us to just analyze the way in which they've dealt with the supernatural. They've also been dealing with fascism and communism. And they said, this is absurd too. This is meaningless for man, because man is not an animal. He's not just the result of biological evolution alone. For man has a distinctiveness about him. And the distinctiveness of man is his desire and capacity for freedom. But man is also a part of a collectivity. He's a part of society. And if man is to be free, he must also respect the freedom of other men. But in that respecting of the freedom of other people, there is always going to be tension and a problem. And therefore, the existentialists come up with the phrase, the ethics of ambiguity. Which is a good term. Now, what is the value of existentialism? First of all, it has certainly shown the falseness of ecclesiology in its traditional forms. Especially in the so-called state church, established church,
official church kind of concept. For you see, so much of religion had become professionalized, and people were paid to be professional go-betweens, that the man himself had no relationship to God. And this is important. And the existentialists have done a great deal to point out how the church tends to keep people from God rather than leading people to God. Now, please don't misunderstand me. I am not opposed to the visible church. The visible church is the one institution that God has used through the ages for His glory. And some people who talk so much about the invisible church have an institution that's not much earthly good. And this church is the church for which Jesus Christ died, and of which you and I are members. We are concerned about this church because we are part of this church. This is the instrument of God, and the gates of hell, Hades, death, are not going to prevail against it. It won't die out. It may go through hard times, just as the Israelites did in Babylon. Second thing, the existentialists have probably done more to convince modern man that he's a sinner than probably anything else. For there was a time, you know, in which the church had engaged in a kind of old-fashioned modernism. It's old-fashioned now. Every day and every way, we're getting better and better. If anything was false, that was. And the existentialists have said, this is utter trash. Have you ever read The Fall by Camus? I recommend it to you. Camus, the great French novelist. Existentialist. The Fall is the most penetrating analysis of the sins of modern man. Sophisticated, acceptable modern man. I certainly was convicted of sin when I read this. This is a penetrating analysis of modern man. Or if you like, read a book called The Rebel. An analysis, for example, of the whole concept of rebellion and sin. Theologically treated, anthropologically treated. I don't know whether you've read Dostoevsky, Crime and Punishment. Dostoevsky, without being an existentialist in the technical sense of the word, was one of the first of the psychological existentialists. Crime and Punishment is a magnificent treatment of the psychology of sin. And his brother's Karamazov is a superb novel. That 16th chapter that deals with the great inquisitor. Where Jesus has come back and the great inquisitor meets Jesus and he finds him there and hauls him into jail and says, we'll do your work without you and do it better. This is so many aspects of the church, isn't it? We cannot read a thing like that without being convicted. Or take Frankl, Viktor Frankl, F-R-A-N-K-L. Existential psychiatrist, who has concluded, interestingly enough, that meaning is only to be found in love and suffering. He quotes the Old Testament extensively, coming out of a Jewish background. He's very close to the kingdom. He's not in. But you know, sometimes we can learn from other people, for they may have insights we don't have. The third thing that existentialists have done is to destroy these false theologies. This every day and every way getting better and better. This idea of communism. For existentialists have pointed out so clearly that collective man is no better than individual man. In fact, collective man is even worse than individual man. And there is no help in collectivity. Now, existentialism is not the answer, for it is not a content philosophy. It's only a way of looking at life, a way of asking questions. But it is probably the most penetrating way of asking questions that has come in a long time.
in a real sense, Christians are real existentialists. And the Bible, interestingly enough, does not even discuss the essence of God. He is discussed as the God who acts, the God who performs, the God who enters history. And there's no description of God, but there are many statements about what he does.
Now, existentialism is no answer,
for it is based so largely upon a kind of psychiatric idealism. And our faith is based in the acts of God. But you and I, dealing with this modern world, have got to learn to ask some questions on a level that we may not have asked before. And existentialism is asking questions, and we've got to make some answers. And they've got to be answers that make sense. For the world in which you and I live is going through an intellectual revolution such as has never happened in one generation before. We have entered the space age, not only with the technological implications which come from engineering, but with the philosophical implications which come from an entirely new picture of the universe. Okay? You may ask some questions. Yes?
Would you give us the difference between fascism and Nazism?
Oh, fascism and Nazism, the same thing. Fascism is, well, they are both essentially a rightist movement. One was called fascism, other called Nazism, but I mean, they're both lumped together as fascism in terms of political philosophies. Yes?
This swinging line here, is there a vacuum in the middle?
What's that?
Above this swinging line, is there a vacuum?
No, I don't think there's ever a vacuum. Well, at a time, in a sense, God may be X'd out, but something immediately takes its place. People don't go around with vacuums. Scientism moves in. In fact, scientism pushes God on out. Yes, this is the funny thing. You would think that science would eliminate black cats and this kind of thing. But it doesn't. These people seem to have plenty of place for this kind of thing. And so apparently it simply pivots, leaving gremlins and black cats, but eliminating God. Fascinating development.
Would you say that first century Christianity
of what? Well, it seems to me that what you have, well, let's take paganism. You see, paganism was, the gods had been fairly well, you know, they'd been eliminated. You want me to describe the Roman world into which Christianity went, or what?
No, Christianity existed from the first century after Christ.
Well, among Christians? Oh, among Christians, it seems to me that you do have, if the heresies that we know about from the first century, second century are particularly significant. We know that we've got a lot of difficulties here, whether God or Jesus Christ or Jesus Christ were in God were exactly the same, the Patripassian doctrine or the Docetus heresy, remember, where they said that Jesus Christ just appeared to be God, he wasn't really God. So there were a lot of heresies in dealing with this type of thing and recognizing the Holy Spirit as either an influence or a part of God. This was part of the pattern, and I would say that for the Christians generally, this could be part of it, although the Christians also had a great deal, as we know even from the book of Acts, a great many books of magic and the rest, and this carried right over into the Middle Ages. So I would say that this is generally characteristic of early Christianity. These things became better defined, of course, as people went along. At the same time, after Christianity became an enforced religion, remember, when Constantine adopted Christianity, he made it legal for people to be Christians. Up to the time of Constantine, it had been illegal to become a Christian. But within 50 years after Constantine, it was illegal not to be a Christian. See, so you had to be a Christian. So the whole concept of totalitarianism of the Roman world was carried right over to Christianity, and from then on, the situation is hopeless. Forever, whenever you have a forced faith, then you're going to have all of these other religions go under the ground, and then the Christianity simply becomes a veneer, just as it has in Roman Catholicism under the Inquisition. So if you want to propagate opposition to your faith, then make it an enforced faith. Yes? No.
Yeah, well, it seems to me, ringing the old changes about, you know, God is on our side type of thing. And that we have got to reestablish the old morality, which wasn't very moral anyway. And that we have got to see to it that other people, you know, believe in justice. And that it is our particular form of justice. And that we are now going to establish a pattern which is going to re-establish the hegemony of the United States. The Lebensraum idea that the Nazis had. And this dependence upon individuals, the man on the great white horse type of thing, in which you are dependent upon this one man who has all of this type of enlightenment, and now we must follow him, you see. And that you can use any kind of technique which is necessary in order to put your point across, because the end justifies the means. And of course, if you get caught lying, well, you say, well, after all, you know, there was part of this was true. This kind of thing. This, I think, is a very, very serious type of proposition. And this emphasis upon, well, we don't really have the social responsibility for all these individuals. That we're going to re-emphasize this rugged individualism. And we're going to, you know, the best man comes to the top, and of course we're the best. This type of thing, you see, is a very, very subtle kind of thing. But this is exactly the type of thing that Nazis were talking about. And ourselves first. And America's rights in Cuba, or wherever it happens to be. Of course, we scream to high heaven when there are any of those missiles in Cuba. But we've got plenty of missiles in Turkey, within about 30 miles of the Russian border. And we don't seem to think there's anything wrong with that type of thing. But you see, when we've got to say that no other nation near us can possibly have any other kind of ideological pattern than we have, because only ours is right. No, I'm not saying communism is right. But I am saying that if you're going to live in a world, you cannot insist that you alone are going to dictate what the rest of the world is going to be like. And this is what certain groups are trying to do. And this is exactly what Nazism said. Remember when Hitler declared war against Poland, he said, the outcome of this will determine what's going to happen for the next 1,000 years. And this is exactly what some other people would like to establish. And I think that this is terribly dangerous. And particularly, did you read the Times newspaper had a very interesting article quoting some of these modern politicians, and the way in which they are using expressions which sound almost like an evangelist? God and country and all this type of thing? Let's don't kid ourselves. That's just plain politics. Let's don't get God involved every time we turn around. Because this isn't what God told people to do. So it seems to me this is a very, very dangerous thing. And you could take some of those phrases and match them with an evangelist phrases, and you'd almost think you were hearing Billy Graham sometimes. And just dragging God in, you know, in order to do some of our dirty politicking, is a very, very dangerous kind of thing. So I feel that we're in danger in this business. And particularly on this race issue. When you can have, of course, I'm very glad for the results of that primary in Wisconsin. Because it shows the race issue is not a Southern problem, it's an American problem. And it's a human problem. But we've got a problem on our hands. And our attitude and the attitude of some of these people with regard to the Negroes is exactly the attitude of the Nazis with regard to the Jews. We'll put them in their place. And we're not going to be contaminated with them. And it's very interesting that when any group ever denounces another group as a minority, they always charge them with excess sexual capacities. The very thing that is happening right now in the propaganda against Negroes. The interesting thing is, of course, that where did all this miscegenation take place? If it wasn't with white men, with Negro women. But now, of course, white men can't admit the Negro men might be attractive to white women. We always wanted a one-way proposition. A Negro sociologist, anthropologist friend of mine was invited to the South to listen to one of these discussions. And, of course, they got around to miscegenation. And he said at the end, "I just want to ask you, gentlemen, a question. Are you as afraid of the morals of your sons as you are aware of the morals of your grandfathers?" Let's face it. The reason this thing has become so visceral is because it enters into one of these very basic elements of sex dominance. Let's face it. But when we try to do this thing on any other issue than a moral issue, and try to bring God in to defend our status quo and our position, and us being the privileged race, and God having chosen us for this great future and for this day, and we are the chosen one of God, this is dangerous stuff.
Well, I would say this, that the genius of Christianity is not that it is a system, but it is a power to sanctify any and all forms of life. So that you don't have to have a particular political philosophy. You can actually be a Christian and be a Democrat, you know. Some people don't think so. Now, this is the important thing about the Scriptures, the New Testament. The Old Testament presented a particular theocracy, didn't it? The New Testament doesn't discuss this theocracy. In fact, doesn't advocate this theocracy. It abolishes the law, doesn't it? As such. But the power of the gospel is not in its institutional form, but in its power to sanctify all forms. And we've got even churches that are Episcopal in structure, Presbyterian in structure, Baptist congregational in structure. And the interesting thing is they all try to go back to the New Testament to find their validation. And of course we know that the earliest church was simply a reflection of the Sanhedrin, a self-perpetuating group of elders. And as it moved out into the Jewish world, the church became more and more a picture of the synagogue. In its structure. We know that from the Didache, which, you know, the early teaching of the apostles. And then, as it moved out into the Greco-Roman world, it followed the pattern of the Greco-Roman world. It became Episcopal in structure, didn't it? Presbyterianism developed in Scotland and in Switzerland, where you had clan government anyway, in an era, a time when the feudalism was breaking down. And Baptist congregational government developed among small minority groups in a face-to-face relationship who had imbibed some ideas from the Age of Enlightenment. Now, it's wonderful how we all go back to the New Testament. But we are the creations of historical developments. I think we have to face this fact, you see? And God has blessed all of these forms, hasn't He? Of course He has. Now, the power of the gospel is not in the structure, but in its sanctifying power. Now, given a belief in the capacity for sin that man has, I think any intelligent Christian is going to try to put in some checks and balances. But they can be done in various ways, can't they? Theoretically, of course, a theocracy run by completely sanctified men would be wonderful. We once had a prof of economics at Michigan. He was a wonderful fellow. And he would take a particular economic system and he'd chart it. Say, absolutely marvelous. Perfect. Except for one fact. Original sin. And then he would chart another one. Very efficient. Excellent. Would work marvelously in the United States. Except for capacity for sin. Then he would go on for another one. I think this teaches us something about this problem of checks and balances, doesn't it? To keep in control the proclivities of man, his demonic qualities. Sin in Hinduism is primarily violation of ritual observance. If you have not performed proper ritual observance, if you have eaten without the proper kind of ceremony, if you have killed something, this is sin. A missionary friend of mine had a fellow come in and said, Oh, I'm such a sinner. And she thought, oh, this is marvelous. At last, this man is ready to confess. And he said, oh, just think how many thousands of fish I've killed. He was a fisherman, you see, by trade. Well, this is not really sin in that sense, when he was beating his wife and being immoral and all the rest. So, by and large, in religions over the world, there is very little connection between religion and morality, as we know it. For religion is a technique for the use of supernatural powers to gain position in society and perpetuate yourself into the future. And morality is something quite divorced, by and large, from religion. Now, if a religion admits this problem of sin, it deals with it primarily through ritual cleansing. And you make certain kinds of gifts, offerings, expiations, propitiations. Very interesting. Then in religions, generally, you propitiate God. In Judaism, you expiated sin. You never propitiate God in the Old Testament. This is a very important distinction. Now, in Islam, you may commit certain kinds of sins, which of course may be overcome by various forms, penance, prayers, ritual incantations, all this type of thing, gifts, giving of alms, many ways in which you can overcome it. Normally, however, the ways of overcoming it are not as bad, you see, as the sinning, not as difficult, so it sort of encourages sin, and at the same time brings money into the coffers. That's a normal technique in most religions. Maybe we have time for one more question. Well, I think that Islam is not such a great competitor, although you're quite right. Islam is increasing at least 6 times faster than Christianity in West Africa. And it's very, very hard to make a dent. But remember, Islam has never asked any questions and it's never given any answers. Islam is popular wherever it has an opportunity for social or political domination. But it has no great wide appeal to the world. For it has never really asked serious philosophical questions. Buddhism has. And Buddhism tries to give these answers. And Buddhism has, therefore, a wider appeal. And in the great dialogue that we're going to be talking about later in this world, Buddhism is going to be a much more significant factor, it seems to me, than Islam. Because Islam cannot keep its present rigid structure too long. It's just bound to crack. But Buddhism has incredible elasticity to it. And an elastic system is far more difficult to deal with than a monolithic system. For once it cracks, it really splits open. Well, we've gone on, I'm afraid, too far, too long. We'll continue with this tomorrow and on to Tuesday, so you'll have plenty of time to ask some more questions. Shall we bow in a word of prayer? Heavenly Father, how we thank Thee for Thy goodness, Thy graciousness to us. Thy marvelous provision for us, O God. Help us to understand. Not just that we may know, but that we may live.
that we may know thy will, and that we may do it, that we may be strengthened in our faith, made more effective in our witness, more righteous in our living. For we pray this in the name of Jesus Christ, who gave his life that we might have life and have it more abundantly. Amen.